Czar, all history, all the time. I'm the History Czar, Paul, and I'm here with
Producer Million.
And this week's show is going to be on the Scottish Jacobite uprisings with Cindy Villar. Cindy, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Did I pronounce your last name right? I forgot to ask you before we came on.
No, it's actually pronounced Valor.
Valor, see? That's what happens when you don't prep. And you have a producer that's not going to cut that out so he can embarrass the czar. So there you go. So I apologize for that.
No problem.
Cindy Valor. Hey, we'll do take two. See, now I got it right. Let's recap our prior show and just move along. It was the Sunshine Tunnel Massacre with Joyce Faulkner, and she talked about it was a Korean War incident and where American prisoners of war, she told about their journey over 3 months in captivity, which ended up outside of Seoul with the American forces chasing the North Koreans, and they basically took American POWs off the train and massacred them, and 30 survived, and she wrote a book on it. It was quite gripping, quite moving interview. If you want to hear about real heroes and the sacrifices made for the United States, that's a show you want to listen to. And you can find that show at historyczar.com. You can check out our blog at historyczar.wordpress.com, where we have more information about each and every show. And you can check out our Facebook page, History Czar Internet Radio Program. Well, we got Cindy Valor on the line, and she's going to talk about the Scottish Jacobite Uprising. Cindy, why don't you tell us about your background and experience first, and then we'll get into the big picture of what was going on in Scotland and England around the mid-18th century.
Okay. I'm a former librarian, and when my husband was transferred to the Midwest, he told me I could begin writing full-time. So I started work on a novel called The Scottish Thistle, which is set in Scotland during the Rising of 1745 and involves the Camerons and the MacGregors, the two primary clans that I chose to write about. And so I've been writing since then, since Amber Quill Press published the book in 2006. I have become very active in the Clan Cameron Association, and I go to some of their the Scottish festivals, and I promote the book there, and I talk about the rising. I also was named the first North American friend of Clan Cameron for some of the stuff that I've done with them to promote the Camerons.
Sounds pretty good. What was your education background?
I have a master's in library science, and I spent 20 years as an educator, mostly as a librarian, but also a teacher. And now I teach workshops, both on Scotland, Scottish history and culture, and maritime history, piracy, and writing, particularly historical fiction.
So similar to the czar, and I think many people that are interested in history, are you a book junkie?
Oh yes, I have my front room in our house is my library, and it has over 1,000 volumes in it.
Other than that, she's not reading much.
No, not at all.
A woman after my own heart. My wife's a book junkie also. Going to Barnes & Noble on Saturday nights our big excitement. So, living in Las Vegas. I know. Can you handle that, Producer Million?
No, not really.
All right. Hey, Cindy, why don't you give us an overview of where history was at in England and Scotland around the mid-18th century to set the stage for the uprising?
Okay. Well, first, to set the stage, you have to understand how we got to this point. And the easiest way to do that is to talk about who was king and who was queen. And when Elizabeth I died, the King of Scotland, James VI, was invited to become King of England, and he became known as James I. So James VI and James I are the same person. James I had a son named Charles I, and he's the king who was beheaded by Cromwell and the Puritans.
It's a Nick and Interrupt 1 second, and
sure.
I apologize. Elizabeth I died 1603, and
yes.
Charles was beheaded 1647, right?
1649.
So we're in the 17th century, heading toward the 18th, right?
Exactly.
All right. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
That's okay. Now, Cromwell oversaw England for a while. On his death, Charles I's son, Charles II, came back and ruled England. He died without any legitimate children, so his brother, James II, became King of England. And he's known as both the Second and the Seventh, the Second of England, Seventh of Scotland. James had actually married before he became king, and he had a Protestant daughter named Mary. But after he became king, or soon or shortly before he became king, he married a Catholic woman, and that really bothered the English Parliament. As long as he had a Protestant daughter named Mary, no problems, because she would become queen when he died. But eventually, his wife had a baby, and this was James Francis, who became James III, although he was never actually crowned king. Well, England was not going to handle this anymore. They don't trust the Catholics. They want out. So, the Parliament asked Mary and her husband to come over and rule England. And James fled England with his family. So then William and Mary, ruled. When Mary died, William took over. When William died, Mary's sister Anne became Queen of England. Now, both William and Anne had no children who outlived them. So England had to come up with a way to solve who would become king next. And they were not going to allow James, who had the right to come back, and his family to rule, because they're Catholic. And so they, in 1701, the Parliament passed the Act of Settlement. And what this said was that only Protestants could rule England and Scotland, England in particular. And so when Anne died, the crown passed to a relative of hers through James VI, which would be her great grandfather. And that person was George the Elector of Hanover. His great grandmother had been the sister of Charles I of England. And she married a German, which is where the House of Hanover came from. So when George becomes king, he comes over to England and sits on the throne. Now, I got to step back a bit. In 1707, Parliament passed a second law, which brought England and Scotland under a single crown. Until then, there was always two crowns, two separate countries. Now they're a single country, which doesn't set well with everyone, particularly James. James is from the House of Stuart. George, of course, is the House of Hanover. And the House of Hanover continues to rule England. They're just called the House of Windsor now. Because of the world wars, the monarchy wished to disassociate themselves with Germany, so they changed the name of the royal house. So since George I became ruler in 1714, the House of Hanover has ruled ever since. But in 1715, the Jacobites decided they would try to regain the throne for James II. They tried again in 1719. Both times failed.
Sinead? I'm just going to jump in because we're heading. No, you're fine. We're just heading on to break. So,
okay.
Well, that's a good spot to break. And we're at 17:19, and we're going to come back and pick up the story. That this is almost like a soap opera with somebody's somebody's relationships. So we want to come back after the break. You're listening to the History Czar, all history, all the time. Hi, and welcome back to the History Czar, all history, all the time. I'm the History Czar Paul, and I'm here with
Producer Million.
And we have Cindy Valor on the line, who's going to be, who is talking about the Scottish Jacobite uprising in 1745. But in the first segment, she was giving us the background and history in terms of what led to the uprising. And it's basically a story of kings and queens and their interrelationships and how they came about. She started with Elizabeth's death in 1603, went through the Jameses. There was a period of Cromwell in that uprising, which I think Cromwell died in 1660, if my memory is accurate. And obviously she mentioned Charles, I think it was the second, who was beheaded in 1649. Went through that period, brought us through the Mary and William period, and was in the early 18th century where the Hanoverian crown came about after the death of Queen Anne in 1714, and the Jacobites were trying to retake the throne in 1715, and we left off in 1719. So pick up the story there, Cindy.
Okay. Well, something that you have to understand in Scottish history is that the House of Stuart had ruled for hundreds of years, and James II, who is James the Seventh of Scotland, was considered what the Highlanders would call the Archley, the High King of Scotland. And they never felt that they had given up the right to have James as their king. James tried in 1715 and 1719 to gain the throne, but failed. And actually his son tried that. And he failed. And 1745, he's too old. So that falls to his son, who is Charles Edward Stuart, also known as Bonnie Prince Charlie. And he's a handsome, intelligent, charismatic, determined person. But he's also shallow, self-centered, stubborn. And if things don't go his way, he's very sulky. One of his commanders, a man named Lord Elcho, said he knew nothing of geography or of history, and he believed that the whole country was his property, and the word subject meant slave. And Bonnie Prince Charlie was the person that everyone saw as the leader of the Jacobite army when he came over. He didn't actually command right away. That was given to a man named Lord George Murray, as well as someone else who I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about because most people would never hear of him. But Bonnie Prince Charlie arrived in the Highlands in July of 1745. And this is seen as the beginning of the Rising of 1745, or the 45 as it's sometimes called. Now the 45 is often seen as a war of Highlanders against Lowlanders, and that's wrong. It's not between England and Scotland. It's not between Highlanders and Lowlanders. It's not between Catholics and Protestants, but it's actually an episode in the War of Austrian Succession, and specifically it's civil war within Great Britain. Pitting brother against brother, father against son. The Jacobite army is composed of, and the Jacobites are Bonnie Prince Charlie's side, are composed of the Highlanders, the Lowlanders of Scotland, Irish and French. The royal army, George I's army, is known as the Hanoverians, and they're made up of English, Scottish, German, and Dutch. And what people fail to remember is that one in every four members of this army is Scottish. So it's the both sides were predominantly Scottish during this. The other thing to keep in mind is that the two armies are not the same. The Jacobite army, the principal fighters are the Highlanders. Not all Highlanders, not all the clans came out for Bonnie Prince Charlie, but those that did, they gave their loyalty to their chiefs, not the prince. In the way clans structure is formatted, Highlanders give loyalty to their clan chief, and the chiefs give loyalty to the prince or the king. And that dates back centuries in how that's formulated. So we're not fighting for the prince, we're fighting for our chiefs. The other thing is the Highlanders are not a disciplined army. In fact, the whole army, unless they were actual soldiers like the cavalry, they're not disciplined fighters. So that if they won a battle and the season was, it was fall, they went home to work in the fields. They didn't stick around to see what happened next. Their principal fighting tactic was known as the Highland Charge, where they would charge down from the high ground to the low ground on the enemy. They would scream, they would shout, kind of like the Highland or the rebel yell of the Confederacy. The weapons they used were pistols, muskets, swords, dirks, and anything that could be used as a weapon, including a lockup or axe. Now, only the wealthier people in the Jacobite army had the pistols and the muskets and the swords. The everyday person had whatever he could bring, could even be a farming implement, just whatever he had. And there were, most of the men in this army had never fought before. They, aside from fighting in clan feuds or going on raids, they're just not fighters. The army did have some cavalry, but very few horse. They have some cannon, but again, not great cannon, and the one person who knew how to do siege warfare is killed during a siege. So not real effective. The main commander, as I said, for the Jacobites was Lord George Murray. The problem with George is that he's seen first as a spy among the Jacobites, because although he fought for the Jacobites in the 15 and the 19, he was pardoned by George the First, but because he had a brother who was loyal to George. And so, you know, he's seen as two-sided by different factions within the Jacobite army. However, Murray is a good strategist. He's a natural soldier. He has fighting experience, and he understood the ways of the Highlanders, which earned their respect. His bad points were that he was blunt, he was haughty, and it was his way or no way. So that's the Jacobite side. The Hanoverian side, you have a very well-rested, well-fed, well-disciplined, well-trained, well-armed army. These guys have been fighting on the continent in the War of Austrian Succession. They are very structured so that you have your upper crust officers and you have the regular men under them. They follow orders. If they don't obey, they get punished. So they're likely to obey what they're told to do.
Hey, we're coming up on the break. So, you know, the history czar is not always the most perceptive guy, but it looks like we have a possible mismatch depending on what type of battle would be fought.
Exactly. You did have a mismatch.
Producer Million, any thoughts while you're listening to the story so far?
What kind of farm implement would you bring to a war with you?
You could use hoes.
Wow.
You know, just the lockup or axe is, although it's not a farming implement, it's a two-sided, it's an axe on one side and a hook on another. And the Highlanders, they also would use their They had a way of sliding under a horse if the cavalry was charging. They'd slide under the horse and knife the belly of the horse to bring the soldier down. So they were very inventive in how they could use these things. And what the English armor, the Hanoverians didn't expect was how well they could fight, which gave them an advantage, and they used to their most effectiveness at the beginning of the Rising of 1745.
Oh, perfect time for a break, Cindy.
Okay.
Come back. You're listening to The History Czar, all history, all the time. Welcome back to The History Czar, all history, all the time. I'm The History Czar, Paul, and I'm here with...
Producer Million.
And we have Cindy Valor on the line, who is doing a great show on the Scottish Jacobite Uprising in 1745. In the first segment, she took us through the soap opera of kings and queens in the 17th century and early 18th century in England and Scotland. And she talked about in the second segment some of the... history from about 1719 up until around July 1745 in terms of what was going on up in Scotland and the Highlands and the different claims to the throne. And she had us right around 1745, which was the beginning of the uprising. So pick up the story there, Cindy.
Okay. In July of 1745, Bonnie Prince Charlie comes over to the Highlands. One of the most important men in the Highlands at the time was a man named Sir Donald Cameron of Lochiel. He's chief of the Camerons. And although the Camerons are a small clan when you compare them to the likes of the Campbells, they're a very powerful clan, and he's a very influential person. And the Camerons have always been loyal Jacobites, and even though Sir Donald does not wish to go out for Bonnie Prince Charlie, he's eventually convinced to do so, and he brings the clan out. And in August of 1745, the Camerons and some other Highlanders gather at Glenfinnan, which is in the Highlands, and raise Bonnie Prince Charlie's Royal House of Stuart standard. At that time, the army numbers about 1,200 men. Between the rising of the flag at Glenfinnan until mid-September, they are on their way over to Edinburgh. And back then, they walked it. They didn't ride it or anything else. They walked this way, the route. And there are a few minor skirmishes throughout, but they're real incidental at this point. At Edinburgh, when they get to Edinburgh, the Camerons and several other small groups of clansmen are able to get into the city and take over the city for Bonnie Prince Charlie. The only part of the city that does not fall to the Jacobites is Edinburgh Castle. That's that one that sits up on the top of the hill. If you've ever seen a picture of Edinburgh, that's the castle you see. But Bonnie Prince Charlie spends most of his time at the bottom of the hill. The castle's at the top of the hill. It's called the Royal Mile, and they're at either end of the Royal Mile. So, soon after they get to Edinburgh, the army encamps over to the east of Edinburgh, and eventually they will fight at what the Jacobites call Gladsmuir, and most people call the Battle of Prestonpans. The Jacobites call it Gladsmuir because of a prophecy somewhere in the past. Someone has told this prophecy that there will be a big victory here. And true to fact that the Jacobites do win against the British Army. Main reason is that Sir John Cope, who's the commander of the British Army, he expects the attack to come from a specific direction. And although he puts up guards looking out to see, you know, keep watch, the Jacobites find a way through a bog. And by going through this bog, they are able to surprise Cope and his men. And it essentially becomes a rout. By the time the battle's finished, and it didn't take an overly long time for the battle to occur, 1,200, there are several hundred Hanoverian soldiers who have died out of 1,200 men. And Bonnie Prince Charlie's only lost 25. And he's got twice as many men. And in fact, Cope, Sir John Cope, is ridiculed because he actually arrives back at headquarters before news of the defeat of his army arrives. And he kind of lives in shame ever after that. News of the victory gets to London, and it spreads fear and it spreads panic. But instead of taking up the advantage of victory and surprise, Bonnie Prince Charlie decides to wait it out. He just sits around going to parties and having council meetings on a regular basis in Edinburgh. Eventually, it takes 2 months before Lord George Murray can convince the prince that he needs to keep going, that they need to take the incentive. And in November, they head south, and they go in as far as Derby, England, which is 127 miles from London. The closer they got, and by the time they were in Derby, panic is really rampant in London, so much so that there's a run on the Bank of England, and George I is preparing to flee the country. But at the same time, there are two factions within Bonnie Prince Charlie's Grand Council that are having an argument. Lord George Murray believes that the army needs to go back to Scotland to regroup and continue fighting later, in part because this promised support that was supposed to show up when they got into England has not materialized. Also, the support that's supposed to be coming from France hasn't reached them either. This is the farthest south most of the men have ever been. They don't like England, in part because the English citizens find the Highlanders to be barbarians. They think there are rumors that they eat children. You know, they don't see them as regular people. And the other problem is that the Hanoverian army, which is split into three groups, is converging on them. So Murray eventually convinces Bonnie Prince Charlie that they have to turn around and go back to Scotland. And Bonnie Prince Charlie agrees to this, but he's not happy about it, and that will come back to bite Lord George Murray later on at Culloden. So in December, early December, they head north. At this point, by the time they get back to Scotland, they have covered 600 miles in 56 days. And up until now, they have won every single encounter with the enemy that they've had. In January, they have the Battle of Falkirk. And again, they rout the Hanoverians. General Hawley is there. He had, before the battle, he had built a gallows on which he was going to hang all the rebels, but because the Hanoverians lost, he hanged his own men instead. 300 to 400 of his men were dead or wounded. 200 became prisoners, versus Bonnie Prince Charlie only lost 50 wounded and 50 killed. Now, among the prisoners that were captured by the Jacobites are is a man named John Witherspoon, and he's one of the prisoners taken to a castle called Dune Castle. And Gregor Glengyle, who is a chieftain of the MacGregors, is overseeing the prison at Dune Castle. And what I found interesting, one of the first stops that I made when I went to Scotland was Dune Castle, not because I knew it had anything to do with the 45, it was just a castle, and I love to go to castles. Well, while we were in the basement looking at a display, I discovered that this is where it was, that they had used it as a prison during the rising of 1745. And of course, the name John Witherspoon meant something to me from my days of studying American history.
Hey, Cindy, I'm going to have to interrupt you right there because we're at the break.
Okay.
So we'll pick it right up at the break, and we'll head into the finish off the preview is not the right word. The setup is the right word I'm looking for, and then with the Battle of Culloden. So we're looking forward to that. So
okay.
Come back after the break. You're listening to the History Czar, all history, all the time. Welcome back to the History Czar, all history, all the time. I'm the History Czar, Paul, and I'm here with
Producer Million.
And we have Cindy Valor on the line talking about the Scottish Jacobite uprising. First, we had Days of Our Lives, 17th, 18th century style in the first segment with the kings and queens. She took us up through the beginning of the Jacob uprising about 1719 to 1745 in the second segment. In the third segment, we got into the details of the first part of the Jacobite uprising, starting in 1745, moving into 1746. And Cindy was just finishing that up, and we're going to talk about the Battle of Culloden for the bulk of this segment. So, Cindy, you're back on.
Okay. As I was saying, one of the names was the Reverend John Witherspoon. And for most Americans, they would know him as a signer of the Declaration of Independence. And I thought it interesting that here was a man I knew nothing about other than he signed the Declaration, and here he had something to do with the 45. But after this, the Jacobite and the Hanoverian armies make their way up towards Inverness in the north of Scotland. And on April 15th, 1746, the Jacobite army is on Drumossie Moor, what we know as Culloden. Back then, the moor itself was called Drumossie. And one of the things to keep in mind is that at this point, Bonnie Prince Charlie has mistaken the fact that because of all the victories that his men have had, he sees the bravery as meaning the same thing as invincible. And this will prove a tragic flaw in his thinking. It's also the time when he's going to give payback to Lord George Murray, and he's going to take control of the battle. He's not going to let George command the force. So he chooses Drumossie Moor, which is the worst place for the Highlanders because it's flat ground. It's conducive to a regular army charge and artillery and cavalry charges. Not a Highland charge. No high ground for them. On the 15th of April, the Duke of Cumberland, who commands the Hanoverian forces, is celebrating his birthday. So Bonnie Prince Charlie assumes that his cousin, who is the Duke of Cumberland, will allow his men to, have his men fight so that they can celebrate him. And so he draws all his men up in battle formation. So all the Highlanders, all the others who fight for him are drawn up in battle for most of the day. There's nothing more tiring than to stand in battle formation for an entire day and not fight. Then on the evening, after he's dismissed the army to go to rest, they decide to try a night march to surprise the Duke of Cumberland's men, who Bonnie Prince Charlie assumes will be celebrating his cousin's birthday, so they'll be drunk. Well, as all night marches, when you're in a strange area, things go awry. They're still 2 miles away from the enemy camp at dawn, so they have to turn around and come back to Drumossie Moor, where the Jacobite army is tired. They're hungry, and they just fall asleep. It's now the 16th of April. At 1 o'clock in the morning, the Hanoverians have arrived. They've lined up on their side of the battlefield. The Jacobites are lining up. The Jacobites have a very uneven line because it's on a slant. Bonnie Prince Charlie is in command, but he's at the back of the army. He's not at the front of the army where he can see what's going on. There's an enclosure to the left of the Jacobite line, and rather than pull those enclosure walls down, he leaves them up, which allows the Hanoverians to put soldiers behind them, which will fire upon the Jacobites as they come across to the far side. And at this point, there are 9,000 Hanoverian men and 5,000 Jacobites. The Jacobite army starts firing their cannon at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, but they have little effect at what they're doing. The Hanoverians return fire, and they're very accurate. When the Highland clans line up on that front line, the gentlemen of the clan, who are the leaders, are in the front lines, and the least influential members of the clan are at the back of the lines. So when the artillery comes in, they're killing huge swaths of Highland leaders. And they endure this for 20 minutes. Bonnie Prince Charlie, because he can't see what he's doing, doesn't give the order to charge because he's waiting for his cousin to charge instead. And the Duke of Cumberland is not going to charge. He's going to wait for the Jacobites to do it. Well, after 20 minutes, the Highland clan leaders, who are still alive, take charge themselves, and they start charging. So the Jacobite line does not advance in unison. They do it in piecemeal, so they're not all at the same place as they go across to engage the enemy. And so when they do collide, it's chaos. And the other thing that they're not aware of, but that the Duke of Cumberland has been drilling his men in, is how to effectively negate the Highland charge with their bayonets. And they do a devastating effect in making the Highland charge totally useless. At the end of the battle, the Hanoverians have only lost about 300 men, but the Jacobites have lost about 2,000 men. And these are only estimates. They really don't have any good numbers to tell one or the other. Now, the Duke of Cumberland had acquired some orders that belonged to the Jacobite army. And when in these orders, someone, I'm not going to say who because we don't know, placed a forged document that said that Lord George Murray had said that his men, should they win, were to give no quarter to the Hanoverian armies. So with that, Duke of Cumberland gave his men the orders to give no quarter. So after the battle, they went through the battlefield and slaughtered the wounded. The women and children and non-participants who had come to watch the battle, they were slain. They would burn wounded soldiers in the barns. It was just a really gruesome thing. But he didn't care. He didn't end the slaughter there. From there, he took it to the Highlands because they did not want another uprising. At this point, we've had 3 uprisings, and they did not ever want another uprising again. So there was pillaging, there was raping, they burned the houses, they burned the crops, they confiscated livestock, anything to make it difficult for Highlanders to survive. And because of this, the Duke of Cumberland, while he's seen as a hero, a conquering hero in England, to the Highlanders, he's seen as the butcher. And Parliament passes laws that for the Disarming Act that make it you can't wear the plaid, you can't use the drums, you can't play the bagpipes, anything that they see as militaristic or uniting of the clans, they eradicate. And while some, all the leaders are deemed traitors, the regular men are transported to the colonies if they're not hanged or if they survive imprisonment.
Cindy, I'm just going to jump. We got about a minute left, so
okay.
Want to make sure you wrap up well and make sure we get your website and your book out there. So go ahead.
Okay. Just one thing about Sir Donald Cameron of Lochiel and his family. Lochiel does escape, but he's wounded. His brother Archie escapes as well, but he will return later and be betrayed, and he will be the last rebel that's ever executed. He will be executed in 1753. And Lochiel's brother Sandy, a Jesuit priest, he's captured after Culloden and dies in a prison ship on the River Thames. So that's the story of the 45, and it's the basis of my novel, The Scottish Thistle. And you can learn more about it at my website, which is known as Thistles and Pirates, which is at www.cindyvaller.com. You can read an excerpt from the book. You can see pictures of these different of the different places that I talked about that pertain to the Scottish Thistle. You can learn about the Camerons. You can learn a lot of things at my website.
Give that website one more time, Cindy.
www.cindyvaller.com.
And Valor is spelled?
V as in Victor, A-L-L-A-R.
Perfect. Well, that wraps it up today for the History Czar. Next week, Military Writers Society of America. You listen to the History Czar, all history,
all the time.